Good evening. All right, thank you for coming. Basic Judaism class number one, and I guess it begins not just the basic Judaism, basic life, of an introduction to God, right? Who is God? Who is that? What is our conception of what God is? So not only does that play into, generally, you know, we think about this Jewish religion, so it's, who is this God person, but it actually plays very much into this week's parsha. So let's start. You can open up this week in the this week's parsha, page 406 or so. Exodus 22, chapter 20, verse 2. So, which is the first of the Ten Commandments, right? So we may recognize this pasuk, we recognize this verse. Anochi vayidber Elokim es kol avim eilu lemor. That's the previous verse. Oh my assistant.
I appreciate it.
So the So page 406. So the first of the Ten Commandments. Moses goes up to Har Sinai. He comes down, or it's unclear what the order is, but Hashem is saying all of these words. That's the verse before. And then what is the first of the ten? Well, we call them Ten Commandments, but perhaps really ten utterances. Aseres Hadibros in Hebrew, the ten things that were said. So the first thing that was said was, Anuchi Hashem Elokecha, I am God, your God. Right? So that's the first question. What does that mean, God, your God? Hashem is one of the words of names of God, and Elokecha is another one of the many names of God. So why does God introduce himself with two names, right? And the second one, and then how does he then, you know, qualify himself or itself, God? Asher hotzeisicha mi'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beis avadim, who has taken you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery. Right. So question number one. Well, we already did question number one. Question number one is, Who is this Hashem en Elokeinu? What is the difference between the word Hashem as spelled out Yud Hey Vav Hey, or Hashem as written in the English? Hashem literally means your name, right? Which itself is kind of strange, right? I am Hashem, the name. So why is God known as the name? Okay, your God, Elohecha, your God. So Hashem Elokecha. So two names. Why is that part of the introduction? And then the second thing is, how would God? What is God most famous for? If God would introduce himself, what is he most famous for? Right. What would the first thing be on God's resume?
Created the world.
Right. If God was introducing himself to the Jewish people. Right, so we've introduced as, I am God, all of you that are alive today, right, it is because, you know, I made all of that. Right? We heard something like that in the elections recently. Right? But everything that's there, the world, the mountain, right, your shoes, or you're not wearing shoes, your clothes, all of that comes from me. So that would have been a very reasonable thing. So, hi, I'm God, nice to meet you, I created you, right? Instead, that's not the way God introduces himself. Rather, the way God introduces himself is, that took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery. And then continues on and says, and you shouldn't create any other gods, etc., etc., etc. Okay, so that is, those two questions, hopefully we'll be able to have a better understanding of as the night goes on. So, To take a step back, part of the reasons that this is a problem, the two names of God, we'll deal with that first, is the idea that we perhaps have an understanding of God from a perspective that's a little bit off. So Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook wrote many articles. One of the things that he felt was his mission in life. This is now on the source sheet. One of the things that he felt responsible for was to bring what he called the light of God into the world. That he felt the world, he was living in a world that was very dark. He felt that religion was very dark. She felt that religion was somewhat, depressive, burdening. That's the feeling that he got. And he felt that that wasn't the way Judaism was meant to be. So he wrote an article entitled The Pangs of Cleansing. The full translation of it is available in this translation of all this book. It appears in what he wrote, Orot HaKodesh, right? The Holy Lights. That was the book that was one of the books that Cook wrote. And wrote an article called The Pangs of Cleansing. In that book, he does not offer any solutions. In that article, he does not offer any solutions. He just raises the problem. He says, if one looks at Judaism, if one looks at people, not really Judaism, but people's perception of God, so you have a problem. Because the perception that people have is that there is a God that is far and a God that is distant. And God, in a way, controls us and tells us various things that we have to do. And he says that that is a bad way of understanding it. If one takes a look at the underlined part here, he says, the greatest impediment to the human spirit on reaching maturity results from the fact that the conception of God is crystallized among people in a particular form, going back to childish habit and imagination. This is an aspect of the offense of making a graven image of a likeness of God, against which we must always beware, particularly in an epoch of greater intellectual enlightenment. He says, what is the problem going about? The problem that we confront is that while people have developed and people learn, people become more sophisticated, right? Their view of God has kind of stayed the same. And that view of God is represented in movies, represented as a voice, represented as something behind a curtain, something that is far and distant, and that is controlling to us. Either controls us by, these are the things that I'm going to cause to happen in this world, or is controlling in us in that he gave us a Torah, he gave us a book, he gave us a list of commandments that we had to do. And we have to do that. So we're being controlled, right? And if you don't do it, so you're going to be punished, or you're going to be this, or you're going to be that, etc. So all of that, Rav Kook says, is understanding that children get when they're 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, and perhaps it doesn't change. So my teacher, I got much of this understanding. Remember, David Aaron tells a story, I believe I've shared before, although I may not have, with Kirk Douglas, and he's friends with Kirk Douglas, and he was sitting on the roof of Israelite with Kirk Douglas, and Kirk Douglas said to him, Judaism really boils down to twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are, or something like that. To which Aaron said to him, so tell me something, if you had all of the wealth that you have now, if you had that when you were 8 years old, what would you spend it on? He said, well, I'd spend it on junk. Like, what do you spend it on now? Well, more sophisticated things. He said, if you had all the money you have now, and you had all the choices you have now, what would you spend your time eating? He said, well, I'd eat junk when you were 8 years old. So I would have eaten junk. What do you eat now? Well, I eat a little more healthy. He says, why is that if your perception of things have changed, of what is quality goods, and if your perception of what is quality food has changed, why is that your perception of what God is hasn't changed? Right, so if Cook says that is the greatest impediment to the human spirit, that is the line that he uses. And he continues on and says, this is like a couple paragraphs later, that if somebody doesn't change, now again, in this article he doesn't really describe what he wants you to change to. He just describes if one keeps that perception, if one continues on in life in that perception, so then everything will be empty, right? We'll start in the beginning of the paragraph. One submits to a service of God in this empty basis according to the confused notions that are engendered in the soul, that are engendered in the soul when one thinks about God without enlightenment and without Torah. We have here a lower form of piety severed from its source, which is a higher piety. The person increasingly loses the splendor of his world by orienting himself to a lower level of intellectual life. Right? He loses all the things that are good. He walks around, as he points out here, and fear. No grandeur of God is then manifest in the soul, but only the lowliness of wild imaginings that conjure up a form of some deceptive, vague, angry deity that is disassociated from reality. Right? That is kind of the perception one has when they're a child. And if one doesn't continue to learn, says if one doesn't continue to go with his eyes open, so he's going to continue to have that perception for the rest of his life. That either that there is this a God that controls the world and I don't have a way of affecting that, or God has given me a book and I'm responsible to do that. Why? It's unclear to me. I don't really know. Right? So it used to be, Rav Kook says, that back in the old days, what happens if somebody had that perception didn't matter. Right? Because if you were Jewish, you were Jewish, or you were, whatever religion you were, really, you were that religion, and there was no way in or out. Or you just had to do it. And if you, especially in the Jewish religion, if you didn't do what you were supposed to be doing, so then you were thrown out of the community. There was so much social pressure to continue to do what you were doing. But what is he speaking about now? He is now speaking in an era where people do have a choice. Right, where he is seeing, in his towns, in the place that he grew up, many people that were leaving the fold, leaving the tradition, leaving Yiddishkeit, etc. So he said, people have that choice. And if God is going to be this, as he says, big, angry deity that's disassociated from reality, what are people going to do? They're going to shut themselves off. They're going to say, I don't need anything to deal with that. And he continues on the last paragraph that he says that actually is perhaps a good thing about the growth of atheism. Meaning atheism has a temporary legitimacy, for it is needed to purge away those aberrations that attach themselves to that type of religious faith. Because that was why the idea of having no God came into the world, as opposed to having a competition of how to respect or recognize that God. He's entered the world idea of the possibility of having no God. So if there is no God, so then Rav Kook says that one goes back and examines what really is the essence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, what really is, perhaps there is more than what people are led to believe when they are children. So the truth is, it's not just Rav Kook didn't make this story up, didn't create this problem around the year, probably 1910 or so, the early 1900s when he wrote this, but that's how the Rambam opens up his Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed by Moses Maimonides. There's no problem reading in English, because even the Hebrew is a translation of the Arabic. So you could buy this, $9 in Barnes & Noble or so, the entire thing, reprinted all the way back to the 1100s. So the Rambam, in his Guide to the Perplexed, opens up with that issue. I mean, the Guide to the Perplexed is, what is the person perplexed about? Right, who is he talking to? He's talking about somebody that is perplexed about God, right? That is what the entire three chapters, or 1200 pages, is about. So how does he open up? So he opens up by saying that part of our big problem is that we've mistranslated a lot of words. Right? That we have a translation problem. Now he's talking in Arabic, and an understanding problem. But these are the first words of the Mora Nevuchim. Some have been of the opinion that the Hebrew that by the Hebrew tselem, the shape and figure of a thing, is to be understood, and this explanation led men to believe in the corporeality, for they thought that the words "let us make man in our tselem" implied that God had the form of a human being. What's he talking about? So all the way back in the beginning of Bereshis, we'll skip that look, but God says to the angels, right, "let us make man." Why he says it to the angels and why it's plural, okay, that's for another time. But he says, "let us make man bitzalmo," right, in our image. God, man is going to be made in the image of God. So what does it mean to be made in the image of God, right? If somebody was in the image of me, right? So what would I? Oh, that person is in my image. So our first, what would we think that means, right? Right, that he looks, he's 6'3", he's whatever, he's tall, etc. What?
Handsome.
Thank you very much. Wow, all the way
back.
So that perhaps is what I would, my immediate reaction is that. So the Rambam says that's a big problem, to say that that's what it means that man is in God's image. What does that mean? That means that God is corporal. That means that God exists. That means that God is a figure. Right? And he continues on and says that God has a shape, he had a figure and a shape, and that consequently he was corporal. They adhered faithfully to this view and thought that if they were to relinquish it, they would ipso facto reject the truth of the Bible. I mean, if you reject that verse as meaning that man is in God's image, so then you're rejecting the entirety of the Bible. You're rejecting everything. That there's, if there's no God in my image, then there's no God, right? That's the way we would understand it. And further, if they did not conceive God as having a body possessed of face and limbs, similar to their own in appearance, they would have to deny even the existence of God. I mean, if I don't believe that God has arms, and God has legs, and God has a face, and God has a... I don't know, belly button's a good question. My students once asked me if Adam HaRishon had a belly button. Right? The first man. Right?
That's cool.
Good question. I don't know. Haven't figured that out yet. But, right? But does God look the same? Right? So if you assume that God looks the same, so that means that God is great and powerful, and we are, you know, weak and tiny, and God is all smart, and we're all stupid. God is infinite, and we're infinitismal, right? That is everything, and we're nothing. So Maimonides says, if you do that, right, so then you're going to be out of place, right? And then you're just in competition with this other being. And he continues on and says, the sole difference which they admitted was that he excelled in greatness and splendor, and that his substance was not flesh and blood. I mean, God was great, and we weren't. He was, we're flesh and blood, and God is not, but he still has arms, legs, face, and just is with really big biceps and really big feet. So thus far went their conception of the greatness and glory in God, the incorporeality of the divine being and his unity, in the true sense of the word, for there is no real unity without incorporeality. Will be fully proved over the course of the entire treatise. He says, if you unlock, you'll realize that this is not going to be true. In this chapter, in our sole intention is to explain the meaning of the word selim and demut. And he explains, goes on to explain, let me tell you what it means to be in the image of God. I one hand, I could tell you, my child is in my image, right? Meaning he looks like me, he has, short beard, whatever, he looks like me. On the other hand, you say he's in my image in that he acts like me, in that he has the same values as me, that he has the same intentions, that he has the same goals, that he has the same ideals as me. Right? And the Rambam says the word selem means image in terms of intellectual and spiritual ideals. What's the word for looking like me? The word for looking like me is demut, or demus. Right? That's what it means to look like me. You can look into a mirror and see my demus. You can't look into a mirror and see my tselem. Because my tselem is not physical, the Rambam says. That's all of a sudden you read that everything changes with that. Right? God says, let's make man in my image. So what does he mean in my image? I have two arms, he'll have two arms. I have two legs, he'll have two legs. Right? Perfect. Right? And by the way, that might give reason to understand why God would be man, right? Because God made man in his image, right? There's no real reason to assume that God is a man. Right? In fact, some of the names of God are feminine. Right? So you could really sometimes freak out an audience by referring to God constantly as she. And they, like, everyone gets very confused. Right? But there's no reason to make that distinction anymore if all you're talking about is sharing the same values. Now, I just said all you're talking about is like, oh, that's nothing. No, that's everything. Right? Everything is about, are you acting the tselem Elokim? Are you acting in the image of God? Not in the physical image of God, because that means demut. I didn't ask you if you're in demut Elokim. Right? I didn't ask you if you're incorporeal, because you're not. You're sitting right here. That doesn't make sense. Right? But I could ask you, are you acting with tselem Elokim? Is that something that would be representative of God's divine image? Right? That's the question that the Rambam wants to know. So, as we... Let's skip to Parshas Va'eschanan. Most of us probably know this verse. But, it's just good to see it in the Chumash anyways, right? Page 972. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. Page 972. Right, and as you can see at the bottom of the page, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Right? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So some people, we've covered this here before, but that's okay. Listen needs to be reminded every day. That's why we say it twice a day. Right? mind is this is really the goal of Shema, what we're about to say. Listen, Israel. That's words easy enough, right? Here, there's a lot of things you could say. Listen, pay attention, you know, get to it, okay? Fine. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Right? So as we pointed out before, Anuchi Hashem Elokecha, right? In the first of the ten utterances, the Seres HaDibros, it was, I am Hashem, your God. And here it says, listen, Israel, Hashem, your God, Hashem is one. What does it mean, Hashem, your God, Hashem is one? Why is God saying two names? And what does it mean, why do we constantly refer to God as Hashem? Right? That sounds a little strange, Hashem, right? The name. Right? How are you doing today? Blessed be the name. Right? What does that mean? Why is God being represented as the name? So, Yud He Vav He stands for, spells out the Hebrew words Haya Hove Ve'yeh. It spells out the words past, present, and future. Was, is, and always will be. That's the word Hashem, Yud He Vav He. Now, how is it possible? How can we conceive of a being that exists both in the past as well as in the future? As well as in the present, as well as it's here, as well as it's there, as well as it's everywhere. Right? How can we conceive of such a being? We can't. Right? The Rambam writes, you could try to think about it, but eventually you're just going to get a headache. Because you're not going to conceive about it. That is above the capacity of God, of man. Right? That's fourth dimension, fifth dimension, whatever it is. Those are dimensions beyond that man's brain has the power to grasp. So that's the Yud Hey Vav Hey. We can't grasp it. Listen to Israel. There is this being that you cannot grasp. That is the past, the future, the present, the is, the was, the here, the there, everything in one. So what can we call that? What can we label that? We can label it, I don't know. We'll label it the name. Right? The name that represents the thing that we can't possibly grasp. We'll refer to as the name. So that's referred to as we say Hashem. The word Hashem, the name. Right? Baruch Hashem. Thank God. Thank Hashem. Thank the name that I can't conceive, I can't really understand, I can't really, it's everywhere. So that's the first name. That's Hashem. Shema Yisrael, Hashem. Comes the next word, Eloheinu. What is the term Eloheinu? So Eloheinu, of course, is the term of God, which is probably the Western understanding, the Christian understanding of God. That God is, that there is this being that is kind of out there someplace, that's in the sky someplace, that looks down upon us, that sits. When I was younger, I used to picture it as being like in the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, right? That kind of God like sits there in that seat. And just like has all the movie screens in front of him. I remember at some point, I remember thinking about this, like, how's it possible that God sees everything at once? So I came up with this idea that you're programmed that when you start thinking of, come on, God can't actually see me, there's billions of other people that God is looking at. Well, there's this chip that once you think that, so you appear on like that front screen. You know, there's like 50 screens in a room, some are bigger, some are smaller. Well, you're on that front screen as soon as you start thinking, oh God, you can't possibly find me, right? So that's the way you're programmed. So that's Elokeinu, right? The God that is kind of distant, and when you make you do something wrong, right? The God that is separate, and if God is separate, then what do we have the possibility of being? Right? We have the possibility of having free choice. Right? If God is everywhere, if God is past, if God is present, if God is future, right? If God is all of those things all together at once, so what does that include then? What is the at once? Right? That includes me. Right? That includes everything. That includes humanity. If God is within me, then what don't I have? I don't have free will. Right? Elokeinu means that I have free will. Elokeinu means that there is an entity of God that is separate from me. So how is that possible now? How is it possible to say that there is a God that is separate and a God that is distinct, a God that gives me the opportunity that I have free will, and yet at the same time to say that God is everywhere, here, there, everywhere, past, present, and future, all at the same time? How is it possible that both of those can exist at the same time? Thank you, Alan. You got it. It is. Right? And we can think about it more and more and more, and that's kind of what one is supposed to do over the course of their life. But ultimately, you're not going to be able to get that. No one's going to be able to get that. That's what God. That's what Moses asked God at Har Sinai after Bnei Yisrael had sinned. When Moses said, "Please show me your face," and God responded by saying, "Man is sorry. That's against the rules. That you're not going to be. That's beyond you. You're not going to be able to get that." So, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu. Listen, Israel, Hashem Elokeinu. There is this dialectic. Forces that are banging against each other that we don't quite, that we, at least in our mind, have to be banging against each other because they contradict each other. But yet at the end of the verse we say, Hashem El Chad. But yet Hashem is one. Right? And you think about, you know, this verse has a lot of meaning. A, we say it twice a day because we have to constantly remind us of this idea. Right, that on one hand we have our own choice, we have our own decisions to make, and you know it's going to be a day where we're going to have to make decisions about what is the right thing to do, what is the wrong thing to do. And on the other hand, we also have the Hashem, we also have the fact that God is everywhere, God is with us, that God is connected to us, and we have that connection. How are they both possible? Well, we don't really know, but on the other hand, we can feel it sometimes. Right, you feel that I'm making these decisions, but I'm being guided by a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Right, and the more one makes correct decisions, the more one feels the idea that they're guided by a Kadosh Baruch. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. That's why the verse, you know, if a Jew is ever killed for being a Jew, so these are the words that are on their lips. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Because on one hand, we're making a decision. On the other hand, and, you know, we feel very distant from God, like, I'm about to be killed. On the other hand, we feel connected. We feel touched, right? And somehow that works together. Somehow that fits together. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem. So if we go back, so how did this come into existence? I copied it from here, but it really exists in many different places. Before God created the world, which wasn't so long ago. However, we understand the age of the universe, right? From the beginning of our tradition of Adam, Avram, etc., right? It's not that long ago. To Moses, to us, is 3,000 years. 3,000 years, as I figured out, is about 120 generations. Right, 120 generations. On one hand, how many of us know who our great grandfather was? I don't. I didn't know any of my great grandparents. Okay, or great great grandparents, or knew personally. I know who my great 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 grandfather was, but between them, I don't really know. So it's not. The history of the world is not that long. If you think about it. So, before the world existed, at least as we know it, so we assume that there was Kulo Or, that Kodesh Baruch Hu filled the entire world, that it was just light, that it was just the light of God. That means it was fluorescent, means that it was the bunny, the pigtail lights, whatever it means, that there was a lot of light. I mean, it was just godliness. The world was entirely godliness. So how did the world become into creation? How did this that we see and that we feel and that we exist, right? And that we exist with at least the thought that we can make our own decisions, right? So how did that come into existence? So that's a concept called Tzimtzum. It's a concept called that God kind of opened up a space. God removed himself from the world and created a space for man to exist. Does that mean that God really did that? Does that mean that God is removed, that's gone? No, that's not true. God is still present, but God has removed the physical, the clear presence of God. And then what is our role? Our role is to fill that space up. From Soloveitchik, writes it as follows. Infinity contracts itself. Eternity concentrates itself in the fleeting and the transient. The divine presence in dimensions and the glory of God in measurements. It is Judaism that has given the world the secret of tzimtzum, of contraction. Contraction of the infinite within the finite. The infinite within the finite. Right, does that make any sense?
No.
The infinite within, who even turn a phrase like that is amazing, right? The transcendent within the concrete. The supernal within the empirical. And the divine within the realm of reality.
When the Holy One, blessed be He, descended on Mount Sinai, He sent an eternally binding precedent that it is God who descends to man, that man who ascends to God. When He said to Moses, and let them make me a sanctuary and I will dwell among them, right? Vasuli mikdash v'shachanti b'silchan. He told Moshe, it's time to build a mishkan, it's time to build a tabernacles for me. He thereby revealed the awesome mystery that God contracts His divine presence in this world. What does He mean? How did He reveal it that way? Right, that God is out there, but perhaps not as present here. So the job of building the Mishkan, building the tabernacles, building the Beis HaMikdash, and really, in effect, everything that we do in this world, all of the, is in theory, and the hope is that we're bringing God more and more into the world. Right? So when one prays, and when one says a blessing, right, that's what a blessing is. Right, what is a blessing? When we eat food and we have the idea of saying a blessing, more about this in the Jewish observance class, right? But the idea of making a blessing, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu, right? Baruch, blessing. Right, what does the word bless mean? Oh. Right? I don't know what the word bless means. Or Salvechik wrote that it means to increase. Baruch Atah, increased are you, Hashem Elokeinu, God, the infinite, who at the same time is finite, the king of the universe, that has sanctified this thing, or that has commanded us and sanctified this, or has brought bread into the world, that makes it possible to take bread out of the ground. Right? Baruch atah, you have hereby been increased. Because I'm no longer just eating something that grew out of the ground. I'm rather pointing out that it is God that has brought this into the world. Right? And I'm thereby connecting with it. I'm thereby taking my food that I'm eating, the physical act of eating, and I'm turning it into bringing a Kadosh Baruch Hu into the world, bringing God into the world. So, and you think about it, that is the ultimate goal. Right? What do we say at the end? Well, how's the story going to end? Right? So at the end of Aleinu, we say the words, V'nemar v'hayu Hashem l'melech al kol ha'aretz. Right? On that day, it will be on that day when Hashem will rule the entire world. V'yomahu, yeah, on that day it will be Hashem echad u'shemo echad. Right? God and the name will be one. Right? We'll recognize how it all makes sense. How it all fits, that on one hand we have free will, and yet on the other hand, God is somehow totally in charge of everything. Right? That's the macro goal for everybody. The micro goal for each person is what? Is to identify, you know, specifically, how am I bringing Kadosh Baruch Hu into the world? There is a YouTube, I'm not sure I came across this recently. Showed it to my 8th grade class. There is a video of Benjamin Netanyahu meeting the Lubavitcher Rebbe. A 1-minute video. He has a story that's like a 10-12 minute story, but there's like a 1-minute video where he actually, you know, the Rebbe used to give out those dollar bills, right? And Netanyahu, when he was I'm not sure if at the time he was still working at the United Nations or not, but he went to get his dollar bill. and the Rebbe recognized him, and the Rebbe immediately switched to speaking in Hebrew. It's on the video. Immediately went to speaking in Hebrew, and he says, like, you know, I haven't seen you in a while. So Netanyahu says back, I've been busy. To which the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, really, how have you been busy bringing Mashiach down? Have you been busy making Mashiach come? So Netanyahu is like startled, like hard to picture today, right? And he's like, we're trying, you know, we're doing things. So like the Rebbe said that he was fearless. From that video, I finally understood what the charisma that he had. He says, well, what do you mean? What have you done today? We have things going on. Which the Rebbe said back to him, well, it's still the morning. There's still the rest of the day. Which is like, wild. Check it out tonight. Sure, you know, just go to YouTube, Netanyahu, Lubavitcher Rebbe, I'm sure it will come up, right? And that's it. You know, Netanyahu came and he said, like, okay, and he like walks away. You're like, that's the meeting. You know, like the Israeli representative of the United Nations comes, says hello to him for 40 minutes, kind of yells at him, scares him, and like, okay, have a good day. You know, well, you know, I'll see you in another 6 years when you come back. You know? But that is, I think that is the idea. You know, when we say Shema, the whole idea of bring, that's what he was driving at. What have you done to bring Hashem into the world? So if we go back to how we started this year, right? We go back to this week's parsha. This week's section. Page 406. So we can even understand a little bit more now. The beginning of chapter 20. This time we'll start from chapter 20, verse 1. Vaydaber Elohim, God spoke, es kol hadabrim ha'il le'mor, all of these things saying. So why is the term Elohim being used here? Right, now that we understand a little bit of the things here, right? Vaydaber Elohim, es kol hadabrim ha'il le'mor, right? Elohim said, what did he say? Anochi Adonai Elohecha. Right? I am God, your God. Right, so right, every time you see either the word Hashem spelled out, God is spelled out as Yud Hey Vav Hey, or God is spelled out as Elohecha, so you know those are keywords, right? They represent something. Right, now it's a keyword. It's Hashem is the connected, close, eternal, ever present representative of God, and Elohecha is the distant, kingly, judging, somewhat not always present, giving me free will, God. So the Ber Elohim, so if it's that Elohim saying the Aseres HaDivros, saying these words, what is the message that is being conveyed by that? So the message is, right, these are your commandments, right? This is going to be your choice. This is all going to be about, Bechira Chavshis, free will. That's how all mitzvahs are done, by way of free will. Verse 2 is, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am Hashem your God. Besides the God that is giving you these mitzvos, and that is commanding you to do these things, I'm also always going to be there with you. It's not that I am far in and away, and I just want you to be doing your thing, and somehow that's serving me. Right, somehow you, wearing these strings on your garments, or you putting these leather straps on your arm, somehow that gives me pleasure thousands of miles away, right? Because I could see you on my screen from my, from the bridge, right? Somehow that helps me. Why? In what way does that help God, right? Unless you assume, Anuchi Hashem Elokecha. Yes, you are going to be the one to choose this, but I am going to be with you at every step. Meaning that's going to be a way of bringing forth the power of the Yud Hey Vav Hey, the power of the ever-present, always there God. So Anochi Hashem, that explains the first half. I am Hashem, your God. I am the, at the same time, this dialectic of present and distant. God that somehow comes together. Why Asher Otzeisicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Beis Avadim? Why is God, and remember me? I'm the one who brought you out of Egypt. Why isn't it, remember me? I'm the one who created the world. Right? So the Ramban, Nachmanides, says on this verse, says, you know why? Because who remembers the creation of the world, right? They're sitting at our Sinai, right? They were taken out, 40 days ago. They just saw the sea split, the sea split 42 days ago, right? Just saw all the firstborns die in one night 50 days ago, right? So that seems like a pretty reasonable point of reference that God would want to invoke, right? That's very reasonable. The Kuzari, the Sefer Kuzari, written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, a little bit after, somewhat around the same time, I guess before the Ramban, actually. So the Kuzari, of course, is a conversation, a fictional conversation between a Chacham, a Tzaddik, the rabbi, and the king of the Caesars, who was like searching around from religion to religion, and he didn't like the other religions, and now someone told him, you know, there's these Jewish people, I know they're very little and very small, but they have to be very, you know, they happen to have like good things to say, so maybe you talk to him. And the rest of the book is this conversation between the king and the and this chacham, and they and this this rabbi, and they, you know, they have a very long conversation. So very early on in the beginning of the conversation, this is invoked, the idea of this question. Why is Mitzrayim being discussed? Why is Egypt being discussed when God is introducing himself and maybe perhaps introduces us as the creator of the world? So he says that, so the Chacham explains in the Kuzari, he says, because we're aiming for more here. Right? God coming down and saying, you have to serve me because I created the world. So that only invokes the idea that there's a God that created me, and if I, you know, if God created me, chances are he probably has kept the instructions manual on how to end me, and probably makes sense for me to listen to whatever that God has to say. Okay, there's a power in that, but perhaps a greater power is not only am I the God that created you, but I'm also the God. Remember a month and a half ago, I took you out of Egypt. Right? I didn't just create you and get lost. I didn't just create you and become Elokeinu and just become a God that is separate and judging and sits in my comfy chair and looks down. But I'm with you. I was with you in Mitzrayim. I was with you in Egypt. I was with all those plagues and stuff that I didn't want to get you out, and all the frustrations when the Jews wouldn't believe Moshe, and Moshe said, you know, and I convinced Moshe it'll be okay, and Paro kept changing his mind. You think, God kind of says he hardened Paro's heart, okay, but, you know, I think I wasn't frustrated by all the ups and downs that happened over there. Right? I was with you and I took you out. Right? Not just to create that assumes that I created you, he says, the Kuzari points out. Right? God can take you. If God can split the sea, that means that God created the sea also. Right? If God could turn all the water into blood, it means he created all the water also. Right? It means that he knows how all this stuff works. Right? But the greater power is that I took you out of Egypt because you're mine. Because you're my children, right? Because we're going to have a continuing connection, and that's my job. That's you know what I'm going to give to you. My job is to give to you that continuous connection. Your job, and Salvation spells this out one spot in like an amazing way that you know we actually have like a deal, and your job is, and what can you do for me? I mean, it's not just a deal like I'll take care of you if you do my mitzvos. It's I can do for you, I can give you life, and I can give you sustenance, I can give you all the things that you need. What is the one thing that people can do for God? The only thing that people can do for God is to bring God into the world. Right? Is to recognize the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's the thing that we do. And when do we do that? So every time that we do, every time we say Baruch Ata, every time we say, increased are you? You're going through. You're going to be more and more present. You're going to be here. Every time we do something because Hashem told us to do it, or something that demonstrates the power, the wisdom, the kindness of God, right? That's our job. That's what we do. Going backwards. So that's who God is. God is something that we don't really understand, but I think we maybe have a greater understanding, and perhaps we have a greater understanding of our role and how we interact with God. Next week, I believe, is Shabbos, right? Next week is Shabbos? I'm going to look at the sign outside. Sounds right? Okay, we're going to have Shabbos this coming Shabbos, and then next week we'll discuss Shabbos, why we're doing it. Okay, yes, Shabbos.